Companies develop, promote, and carefully select managerial talent grown from inside the company to a greater degree than the comparison companies. They do this as a key step in preserving their core. Over the period 1806 to 1992, we found evidence that only two visionary companies, 11.1%, ever hired a chief executive directly from outside the company, compared to 13, 72.2% of the comparison companies. Of 113 chief executives for which we have data in the visionary companies, only 3.5% came directly from outside the company versus 22.1% of 140 CEOs at the comparison companies. In other words, the visionary companies were six times more likely to promote insiders to chief executive than the comparison companies. Put another way, across 1,700 years of combined history in the visionary companies, we found only four individual cases of an outsider coming directly into the role of chief executive. In short, it is not the quality of leadership that most separates the visionary companies from the comparison companies. It is the continuity of quality leadership that matters, continuity that preserves the core. Both the visionary companies and the comparison companies have had excellent top management at certain points in their histories, but the visionary companies have had better management development and succession planning, key parts of a ticking clock. They thereby ensured greater continuity and leadership talent grown from within than did the comparison companies in 15 out of 18 cases. You can think of it as a continuous self-reinforcing process, a leadership continuity loop. Management development and succession planning leads to strong internal candidates, which in turn leads to continuity of leadership excellence from within, which in turn aids one key concept of this book, preserve the core ideology. Absence of any of these elements can lead to management discontinuities that force a company to search outside for a chief executive and therefore pull the company away from its core ideology. Such discontinuities can also impede progress as the company stalls due to turmoil at the top. In fact, we saw a pattern common in the comparison companies that stands in contrast to the management continuity loop in the visionary companies. We came to call this pattern the leadership gap and savior syndrome. Poor management development and inadequate succession planning leads to a dearth of strong internal candidates, which in turn creates a leadership gap, a corporate stall, and then the search for a savior, which then interrupts the process of preserve the core and stimulate progress. This doom loop happened at Melville Corporation in the 1950s when Ward Melville found he hadn't adequately prepared any successors. Desperate to pass the company to somebody, anybody, because he was anxious to retire, Melville gave the job to a production manager who was ill-prepared and didn't even want the job. The company declined precipitously. "I was shocked to see how fast the numbers can deteriorate when the men are wrong," Melville commented later. Melville then launched a year-long search for an outside CEO to come in and turn around the company. Fortunately, Melville had the wisdom to abandon the outside search and turn instead to developing a promising young insider who over time proved to be a very capable CEO. It happened to Douglas Aircraft in the late 1950s as founder Donald Douglas turned his company over to an inadequately prepared Donald Douglas Jr. "The younger Douglas could not possibly fill his old man's shoes," wrote one biographical account. "The son retaliated against those he considered his enemies, that is, most of his father's management, and replaced experienced administrators with those who joined his team. As Douglas Jr. placed key friends in high positions, talented managers left the company when it needed them most to face the ever-growing onslaught from Boeing. During the early 1960s, the loss of managerial talent caught up with Douglas as it tried desperately and unsuccessfully to catch up to Boeing. Facing an epic crisis in 1966, Douglas Jr. sought salvation in the form of a merger with McDonnell Aircraft. It happened at R.J. Reynolds in the 1970s. Company director J. Paul Sticht, ex-president of Federated Department Stores, torpedoed the planned succession of an heir apparent, then maneuvered himself into the presidency, according to Businessweek. Sticht assumed chief executive responsibility and restocked the management team almost entirely with outsiders. Later, in one of the most famous senior management disasters in corporate history, Ross Johnson, a truly alien element to the company's heritage, became CEO after RJR acquired Nabisco Brands in 1985. Well documented in Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of RJR Nabisco by Brian Burroughs and John Helliar, The Johnson era ended with a junk bond finance takeover by financiers Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts, and Company, who brought in yet another outside CEO. If you're the chief executive or board member at a large company, you can directly apply the lessons of this chapter. Your company should have management development processes and long-range succession planning in place to ensure a smooth transition from one generation to the next. We urge you to keep in mind how the Walt Disney Company, an American icon, got itself in a terrible fix because Walt neglected to build this vital part of a ticking clock. We urge you to not repeat the mistakes made at Colgate, Zenith, Melville, Ames, R.J. Reynolds, and Burroughs. Do not fall into the trap of thinking that the only way to bring about change and progress at the top is to bring in outsiders who might dilute or destroy the core. If you're a manager, the essence of this chapter also applies to you. If you're building a visionary department, division, or group within a larger company, you can also be thinking about management development and succession planning, albeit on a much smaller scale. If you were hit by a bus, who could step into your role? What are you doing to help those people develop? What planning have you done to ensure a smooth and orderly transition when you move up to higher responsibilities? How does this chapter apply to smaller companies and entrepreneurs? Clearly, a small company cannot have a chief executive succession process that begins with 96 candidates, as happened at GE. Nonetheless, small to mid-sized companies can be developing managers and planning for succession. Motorola was still a small company when Paul Galvin began carefully grooming his son to become chief executive. The same holds true for family transitions during the early days of Merck, P&G, J&J, Nordstrom, and Marriott. Sam Walton began thinking about future management of the company before the company had even 50 stores. Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard began formal management development programs and thoughtful succession planning in the 1950s when the company had 500 employees. Interestingly, nearly all of the key early architects of the visionary companies remained in office for long periods of time, 32.4 years on average. So few of the companies faced actual succession while still young and small. Nonetheless, many of them were planning for succession long before the actual moment. This chapter does not mean that outsiders are doomed to fail. It means, rather, that outsiders are much less likely to succeed in making or keeping a company great. In Good to Great, Jim and his research team found further statistical evidence for this point, noting that over 90% of the Good to Great CEOs came from inside their companies, whereas over two-thirds of the comparison companies tried outside saviors and failed to become great. If you come in as an outsider, follow the lead of Louis V. Gerstner at IBM. During the years between Watson Jr. and Gerstner, IBM lost sight of the fundamental dynamic of an enduring great company: adherence to core values, combined with a willingness to challenge and change everything except those core values, keeping clear the distinction between what we stand for, which should never change, and how we do things, which should never stop changing. Lou Gerstner saved IBM not by destroying its core values, but by changing the company's method so as to reignite its core values. White shirts were not a core value, but IBM had begun to act like wearing white shirts was a core value. Gerstner was IBM's Martin Luther, going on a rampage to destroy outdated forms that got between IBM and its ultimate authority, the customer. Most important, Gerstner reminded IBM that, by God, it was IBM. In his superb book, Who Says Elephants Can't Dance?, Gerstner summed up, "Until I came to IBM, I probably would have told you that culture was just one among several important elements in any organization's makeup and success. I came to see in my time at IBM that culture isn't just one aspect of the game. It is the game."
Chapter 9. Good enough never is. Don't bother just to be better than your contemporaries or predecessors. Try to be better than yourself. William Faulkner. The critical question asked by a visionary company is not, how well are we doing, or how can we do well, or how well do we have to perform in order to meet the competition? For a great company, the critical question is, how can we do better tomorrow than we did today? They institutionalize this question as a way of life, a habit of mind and action. Superb execution and performance naturally comes to the visionary companies not so much as an end goal, but as the residual result of a never-ending cycle of self-stimulated improvement and investment for the future. There is no ultimate finish line in a visionary company. There is no having made it. There is no point where they feel they can coast the rest of the way. Visionary companies, we learned, attain their extraordinary position not so much because of superior insight or special secrets of success, but largely because of the simple fact that they are so terribly demanding of themselves. Becoming and remaining a visionary company requires oodles of plain old-fashioned discipline, hard work, and a visceral revulsion to any tendency toward smug self-satisfaction. Continuous improvement has become a management buzzword, but at the visionary companies, the concept has been commonplace for decades, over a century in some cases. William Proctor and James Gamble, for example, used the concept of continuous improvement as far back as the 1850s, over 150 years ago. William McKnight brought the concept to life at 3M in the 1910s. J. Willard Marriott embraced the concept soon after opening his first root beer stand in 1927. Our research clearly supports the concept of continuous improvement, but not as a program or a management fad or a buzzword. In a visionary company, it's an institutionalized habit. It's a disciplined way of life, ingrained into the fabric of the organization and reinforced by tangible mechanisms that create discontent. Visionary companies apply the concept of self-improvement in a much broader sense than just process improvement. It means long-term investment for the future. It means investment in the development of employees. It means adoption of new ideas and technologies. It means doing everything possible to make the company stronger tomorrow than it is today. You're probably getting the impression that the visionary companies are not exactly comfortable places. That's precisely the impression you should be getting. Comfort is not the objective in a visionary company. Let me repeat that. Comfort is not the objective in a visionary company. If you want an easy place to work, if you want an easy life, if you want to coast, don't try to build a great company. Just take the easy path. Nobody ever said building something great was going to be easy. It's going to be hard. Visionary companies understand this, and they install powerful mechanisms to create discomfort, to obliterate complacency, and they thereby stimulate change and improvement before the external world demands it. They force of themselves to change. They don't wait for somebody to come to them or the market to come to them or factors to come to them and say, you should change. They say, we will change ourselves. Thank you very much. To really understand the psychology of a visionary company, you really need to understand a great artist or an inventor. They thrive on discontent. They understand that contentment leads to complacency, which inevitably leads to a lack of creativity and decline. The problem is how to avoid complacency, how to remain self-disciplined, how to ensure that people operate with disciplined thought and disciplined action once you've become successful. How can you keep alive that fire that burns within that keeps people pushing forward, never satisfied, always in search for improvement? Richard Dupree at Procter & Gamble pondered these exact questions, and he was worried that P&G's rise to prominence in the early 20th century might cause the company to become fat, happy, and complacent. What to do? He could have gone around giving passionate speeches about the importance of remaining disciplined. He could have written memos and pamphlets about the dangers of complacency. He could have met personally with managers throughout the company to impress upon them the inherent value of change and self-improvement. But Dupree knew that the company needed something more than just good intentions. He wanted something with teeth in it, something that would continually impel progress from within. Then in 1931, a marketing manager named Neil McElroy came to him with a radical proposal: create a brand management structure that would allow P&G brands to compete directly with other P&G brands, as if they were from different companies. P&G already had the best people, the best products, the best marketing muscle. So why not put the best of P&G against the best of P&G? If the marketplace doesn't provide enough competition, why not create a system of internal competition that makes it virtually impossible for any brand to rest on its laurels? Because the brand just down the hall is going to be nipping at your heels.
The brand management mechanism became a powerful device at P&G for stimulating change and improvement from within. The mechanism proved so effective that it was eventually copied, in one form or another, by virtually every American consumer products company, including Colgate, but not until nearly 3 decades later. The point here is not that a successful company should necessarily create internal competition. The point is that it should have some sort of mechanisms of discomfort in place to combat the disease of complacency. Internal competition is one such mechanism, but it's not the only one. We found a variety of mechanisms across the visionary companies. GE institutionalized internal discomfort with a process called workout. In this mechanism, groups of employees meet to discuss opportunities for improvement and make concrete proposals. Upper managers are not allowed to participate in the discussion, but they must make on-the-spot decisions about proposals in front of the whole group. He or she cannot run, hide, evade, or procrastinate. Mechanism, discomfort, progress. Good enough never is. Nordstrom created an environment where people can never stop trying to improve. Sales per hour rankings measured success relative to one's peers. There are no absolute standards that, once you achieve them, allow you to relax. Nordstrom also tracks customer feedback and links employee compensation and advancement to the trends. As Bruce Nordstrom explained, if you really listen to your customers, they're never really happy. They'll let you know what you're doing wrong, and it just forces you to get better. Fat-headedness is what bothers me most. I think we get so much press about our service and all this stuff, and we start believing it, and then we think we're better than the customer. And then we're dead right there. Not only do the visionary companies build these tangible, catalytic, driving mechanisms of discomfort, but they're also investing in building continually for the future. Put yourself in the shoes of Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard in 1946. You have a small company, less than 10 years old. You've just watched your revenue decline by 50% as defense contracts dried up at the end of the Second World War. You face an imminent cash flow crisis, and it threatens the very survival of your little company. You have no prospects in commercial markets that would immediately solve the problem. Now, what would you do in the same situation? What do you think they did? First, they cut payroll from approximately 200 to 80 people, a painful step that they never wanted to repeat. Faced with the dire circumstances, they simply had to perform major surgery in order to save the company. Second, they vowed that they would never again allow themselves to become overly dependent on the hire and fire government contract business. They simply felt that this would be disrespectful to their people. Hewlett and Packard didn't stop there, however. They took a remarkably bold and far-sighted step for a small company reeling from a 50% decline in business. They decided to take advantage of the fact that all defense-funded institutions were facing hard times, and they therefore set out to hire talented scientists and engineers that had been engaged at government-funded research laboratories during the war. They also decided to keep their best and most expensive in-house talent, not wanting to make cuts that would have been damaging to the long term. The remarkable thing about this decision is that Hewlett and Packard didn't know if the post-war business climate would improve. It was a gamble to hire all these great people and just bring them in without knowing what they're going to do. In fact, the company struggled in the 4 years after that decision and didn't start to grow significantly until 1950. But that far-sighted investment in 1946, going out and hiring all these great people and then figuring out what you're going to do with them, paid off handsomely down the road when those very same talented people produced hundreds of exciting new innovations. As a quick aside, as I'm recording this in 2004, those of you who have read the book Good to Great will immediately recognize this principle at work. Remember in Good to Great, the principle, first who, then what? First get the right people on the bus, then figure out where you're going to drive it. That's exactly what Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard were doing. They were saying, we don't know what the business is, we don't know what we're going to do with these people, but they're great people, and we're going to get them on the bus, and then we're going to figure out, hopefully, somewhere to drive it that we can keep them employed. First who, then what? Tremendous compatibility here between the two studies. Now let's take a quick look at HP's comparison company, Texas Instruments. Now, in fairness, Patrick Haggerty, TI's counterpart to David Packard, also had a long-term perspective. And he also hired top research scientists in 1946, although the company, TI, was not facing the same dire crisis that HP faced. However, as TI evolved beyond Haggerty, it veered away from the difficult challenge set forth at HP, namely manage with a 50-year horizon and perform extremely well in the current year. In the 1970s, TI, unlike HP, began introducing cheap consumer products and making drastic, unexpected price cuts, often at the expense of its dealers, in a bid to grab market share. One dealer commented in 1979, TI is so bent on getting the price down that when it comes to the consumer, they squeeze the quality out. The strategy backfired, leaving TI with financial losses and a damaged reputation. Whereas HP at that point did not lose sight of either the short term or long term, TI's quest for sheer size and growth in the short term eroded its foundation and heritage as a creator of excellent and innovative products and severely damaged its long-term prospects. At their best, visionary companies invest, build, and manage for the long term to a greater degree than the comparison companies in our study. Long term at a visionary company does not mean 5 or 10 years. It means multiple decades. 50 years is more like it. Think about that for a minute. When you're thinking about your planning, when you're thinking about building, are you thinking in a 50-year horizon? Are you building for a 50-year future? Do you think that 5 years is long-term or short-term? 5 years is short-term. And yet, at the same time, these companies do not let themselves off the hook for delivering exceptional results today. Leaders at visionary companies simply do not accept the proposition that they must choose between short-term performance or long-term success. Remember the genius of the and. They build first and foremost for the long term and hold themselves to highly demanding short-term standards. Again, comfort is not the objective. Life is hard, demanding, severe, disciplined in a visionary company. Taking a systematic look across the entire set of companies in our study, we found substantial evidence that the visionary companies invested for the future to a greater degree than the comparison companies. By analyzing annual financial statements dating back to the year 1915, we found that the visionary companies consistently invested more heavily in new property, plant, and equipment as a percentage of annual sales than the comparison companies in 13 out of 15 cases. They also plowed a greater percentage of each year's earnings back into the company, paying out less in cash dividends to shareholders in 12 out of 15 cases, plus one indistinguishable case. Few of our companies reported R&D as a separate line item for long periods in their history, and some, such as Walmart and Marriott, simply don't have R&D in the conventional sense. However, for those pairs in which we have information, the visionary companies invested more heavily in R&D as a percentage of sales in every single case, 8 out of 8. I just want to pause here for a moment and acknowledge something. Those three paragraphs took a wonderful member of our research staff named Jose Vamos an entire year to create. He sat down and systematically created, year by year, income statements and balance sheets for every one of the visionary and comparison companies going back almost 100 years so that we could run these numbers. I suppose for him also, comfort was not the objective. The visionary companies also invested much more aggressively in human capital via extensive recruiting, employee training, and professional development programs. Indeed, the discipline of self-improvement stands out as one of the most clear differences between the visionary companies and the comparisons. Taking into account mechanisms of discomfort and long-term investments for the future, we found that the visionary companies have driven themselves harder for self-improvement in 16 out of 18 cases. Not only were the comparison companies less disciplined, but in a number of cases, they shirked investment for the future, or worse, milked the company at a crucial stage in its history. During the 1970s and 80s, when Philip Morris relentlessly invested in its goal of becoming number one, R.J. Reynolds executives used the company primarily as a platform for their own self-aggrandizement and enrichment. They bought a fleet of corporate jets, referred to as the RJR Air Force, built expensive airport hangars, dubbed the Taj Mahal of corporate hangars, constructed elaborate and unneeded corporate offices called the Glass Menagerie, decorated with expensive antique furniture and exquisite artwork. The only company I've ever worked for without a budget, according to one vendor. And sponsored celebrity athletes and sporting events with dubious marketing value. When asked about the wisdom of these expenses, then-CEO F. Ross Johnson responded simply, "A few million dollars are lost in the sands of time." If you'd like to read a riveting account of the decline of R.J. Reynolds, I warmly recommend to you the book Barbarians at the Gate, which lays out this entire story in its gory detail and reads like a page-turning novel. Let me share with you the decline of a great American franchise. In 1960, Howard Johnson Sr. abruptly retired from the company he built, leaving it in the hands of his son, Howard Jr. "I've never seen anything like it," said a longtime associate. "Most men don't want to let go of what they've built. He just walked away, and that was that." He left behind one of the best-known American businesses, with 700 restaurants and hotels dotting highways around the country, all of them adorned with eye-catching, bright orange roofs, and beloved by Middle America. J. Willard Marriott Jr. commented at the time that he hoped his company, the one he inherited from his father, could one day be as successful as Howard Johnson. By 1985, Marriott had not only become as successful as Howard Johnson, but had far surpassed it by a factor of 7 times. What happened? Partly, as Howard Johnson Jr. described in a 1975 interview, "We are a reacting company. We don't try to anticipate the future. In this business, you can't look too far ahead, maybe 2 years. While Marriott pushed itself to continually improve the quality and value of its service, Howard Johnson became, quote, overpriced and understaffed purveyors of pallid food hamstrung by outdated ideas, unquote, in the words of a business publication. A former Howard Johnson executive commented, "Hojo always seemed to have ideas to upgrade the restaurants and hotels, but they never wanted to spend the money." An executive from Imperial Group, the company that bought Howard Johnson in 1979, explained why it sold the company 6 years later for less than half of its acquisition price. Profits were artificially high. Its reinvestment had been neglected. Pennies had been pinched on staffing, menus, and renewal. It was milking the business by not reinvesting. At one point, Johnson Jr. moved to elegant quarters in New York's Rockefeller Center and spent the bulk of his time socializing in elite society. Summed up a competitor, "Every time I saw Howard Johnson, he was always telling me how he was going to cut costs. I don't think he spent enough time at his restaurants. If he'd eaten at his own restaurants more instead of lunching at 21, a fashionable New York restaurant, he might have learned something." We see good news and bad news in this chapter. The good news is that one of the key elements in being a visionary company is strikingly simple. Good, old-fashioned, hard work, dedication to improvement, and continually building for the future. That's going to take you a long way. It's pretty straightforward, easily within the grasp of every manager. The bad news is that creating a visionary company requires huge quantities of good, old-fashioned, hard work, dedication to improvement, and continually building for the future. There are no shortcuts. There are no magic potions. There are no workarounds. To build a visionary company, you've got to be ready for the long, hard pull. Success is never final. It's a lesson Howard Johnson never learned. A colleague of mine from Brazil lunched one day with Sam Walton at a small diner in Bentonville, Arkansas. As they were eating their hamburgers, Sam looked up at a man who ambled into another part of the restaurant, pointed to him, and said, "See that? That person over there? That's Joe. I really admire Joe." Now, keep in mind at this moment, Sam Walton is probably the most successful retailing entrepreneur in all of American history. And here he is pointing across the restaurant at some guy named Joe. So who's Joe? "Joe really impresses me. He used to be a truck driver, but now he has his own business raising chickens. I can learn a lot from Joe." Think about that. the most successful entrepreneur of his age, and he can still learn. The Parable of the Black Belt. Picture a martial artist kneeling before the master sensei in a ceremony to receive a hard-earned black belt. After years of training, the student has finally reached a pinnacle of achievement in the discipline. "Before granting the belt, you must pass one more test," says the sensei. "I am ready," responds the student, expecting perhaps one final round of sparring. "You must answer the essential question. What is the true meaning of the black belt?" The student paused, thought, and then said, "The end of my journey, a well-deserved reward for all of my hard work." The sensei waits in silence. Clearly, he is not satisfied. Finally, the sensei speaks. "You are not ready for the black belt. Return in 1 year." A year later, the student kneels again in front of the sensei. "What is the true meaning of the black belt?" asks the sensei. "It is a symbol of distinction and the highest achievement in our art," says the student, proudly thinking he got it right. The sensei sits in silence, says nothing for many minutes, waiting. Clearly, he is not satisfied. Finally, he speaks. "You are not ready for the black belt. Return in 1 year." A year later still, the student kneels once again in front of the sensei. And again the sensei asks, "What is the true meaning of the black belt?" The student pauses and then responds, "The black belt represents the beginning, the start, of a never-ending journey of discipline, work, and the pursuit of an ever higher standard." The sensei waits, pauses, lets it sink in, and then says, "Yes, you are now ready to receive the black belt, for you now understand that it represents the beginning of your work."
Chapter 10, Building the Vision. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. T.S. Eliot, Four Quartets. Vision has become one of the most overused and least understood words in the language of management. All of us know vision is important, but what exactly is it? Talk to 20 executives and you'll probably get 20 different definitions. Ask these same executives, "Does your company have a vision?" And at least 18 of them will say yes. Almost every company has a vision, yet when carefully examined, they turned out to be based on a hodgepodge of definitions. To demonstrate this point, suppose we asked our imaginary sample of executives to describe what vision is supposed to do for their company. We would get a wide variety of answers. We know this happens because we have posed this question to executive groups numerous times. Stop for a minute and ask yourself, what is vision supposed to do for my organization? What role should it play? More than likely, you came up with at least 4 or 5 answers. In the times we've done this exercise, the executives generate a list that typically looks like this: compass for the organization, framework for strategy, guide for individual behavior, source of inspiration, description of the organization's reason for existence, basis for culture, glue to hold the organization together, source of identity, identify both short and long-term goals, picture of a desired future, motivator of high performance, magnet attracting desirable people to the organization. Consider this list and ask yourself, of the dozen items listed, how many does my company's vision satisfy? Be tough with your analysis. If you are, you'll probably conclude that your company's vision only meets a small number of the expectations we have for vision. Why does this happen? Were the executives who developed the vision not serious about their task? Did they not put a lot of time and effort into coming up with the very best vision they could? If the truth be known, the process of developing a company's vision usually takes lots of executive time. Often happens during an executive retreat at some mountain or seaside resort, consists of much give and take over basic ideas, and consumes lots of energy as the company's leaders wordsmith their way to the final statements. So why is the output so ineffective? Why is it not memorable? And why does it not affect the behavior of everyone in the organization? We believe that the reason most vision statements fail to meet all that we expect of them resides in the fact that executives developing their company's vision do so without any guiding framework. They use their intuition about vision, or their own unique definition of vision, and as a result, produce something that doesn't meet all of our expectations. In the end, the output of most vision-setting efforts gets filed someplace and eventually forgotten, or gets written on plastic cards to be carried by all employees who, when asked about their company's vision, usually wind up having to pull out the card and read it because they don't remember its content. If this happens in your company, your vision probably does you absolutely no good. The remainder of this chapter, we believe, helps you out of this difficulty, for we propose a clear, logical framework rooted in the research reported in the previous 9 chapters. This framework will guide you in the creation of a vision that meets all the expectations we have of it. The Vision Framework. A well-conceived vision consists of 2 major components, a core ideology and an envisioned future. Notice the direct parallel to the fundamental preserve the core, stimulate progress dynamic. A good vision builds on the interplay between these 2 complementary yin and yang forces. It defines what we stand for and why we exist. It does not change the core ideology, and sets forth what we aspire to become, to achieve, to create, that will require significant change in progress to attain the envisioned future. Core ideology. Core ideology defines the enduring character of an organization, its self-identity that remains consistent through time and transcends product market life cycles, technological breakthroughs, management fads, and individual leaders. In fact, the most lasting and significant contribution of those who architect visionary companies is the core ideology. Core ideology provides the bonding glue that holds an organization together as it grows, decentralizes, diversifies, expands globally, and attains diversity within. Think of core ideology as analogous to the principles of Judaism that held the Jewish people together for centuries without a homeland, even as they spread in the diaspora. Or think of it as like the truths held to be self-evident in the United States Declaration of Independence, or the enduring ideals and principles of the scientific community that bond scientists from every nationality together with the common purpose of advancing human knowledge. Any effective vision must embody the core ideology of the organization, which in turn consists of 2 distinct subcomponents: core values, a system of guiding principles and tenets, and core purpose, the organization's fundamental reason for existence. Core values. Core values are the organization's essential and enduring tenets, a small set of timeless guiding principles that require no external justification. They have intrinsic value and importance to those inside the organization. Disney's core values of imagination and wholesomeness stem not from a market requirement, but from an inner belief that imagination and wholesomeness should be nurtured for their own sake. Ralph Larson, CEO of Johnson & Johnson, put it this way: "The core values embodied in our credo might be a competitive advantage, but that is not why we have them. We have them because they define for us what we stand for, and we would hold them even if they became a competitive disadvantage in certain situations." The key point is that an enduring great company decides for itself what values it holds to be core, largely independent of the current environment, competitive requirements, or management fads. Clearly, then, there is no universally right set of core values. A company need not have customer service as a core value. Sony doesn't. Or respect for the individual. Disney doesn't. Or quality. Walmart doesn't. Or market responsiveness. HP doesn't. Or teamwork. Nordstrom doesn't. The key is not what core values an organization has, but that it has core values. Companies tend to have only a few core values, usually between 3 and 5. In fact, we found none of the visionary companies we studied and built to last to have more than 5 core values, and most have only 3 or 4. And indeed, we should expect this, for only a few values can be truly core, values so fundamental and deeply held that they will change seldom, if ever. In identifying the core values of your organization, push with relentless self-honesty for truly core values. If you articulate more than 5 or 6, there's a good chance you're not getting down to the core essentials, and probably confusing core values, which do not change, with operating practices, business strategies, and cultural norms, which should be open for change. Remember, these values must stand the test of time. After you've drafted a preliminary list of the core values, ask about each one. If circumstances penalized us for holding this core value, would we still keep it? If you can't honestly answer yes, then it's not a core value. A high technology company we work with wondered whether it should put quality on its list of core values. The CEO asked, "Suppose in 10 years, quality doesn't make a hoot of difference in our markets. Suppose the only thing that matters is sheer speed and horsepower, but not quality. Would we still want to put quality on our list of core values?" The members of the management team looked around at each other and finally said, "To be honest, no." Quality stayed off the list as a core value. Quality stayed in the current strategy of the company, and quality improvement programs remained in place as mechanisms for stimulating progress, but it did not make the list of core values. This same group of executives then wrestled with whether it should put leading-edge innovation on its list of core values. The CEO asked the same question. Would we keep it on the list as a core value no matter how the world changes around us? This time, the management team gave a resounding yes. We always want to do leading-edge innovation. That's who we are. It's really important to us and always will be, no matter what. And if our current markets don't value it, we will find markets that value it. Leading-edge innovation went on the list of core values. A company should not change its core values in response to market changes. Rather, it should change markets, if necessary, in order to remain true to its core values. Who should be involved in articulating core values varies depending on the size, age, and geographic dispersion of the company. But in many situations, we like to suggest a Mars group. It works like this. Imagine you've been asked to recreate the very best attributes of your organization on another planet, but you only have seats on the rocket ship for 5 to 7 people. Who would you send? They are the people who likely have a gut-level understanding of your core values, have the highest level of credibility with their peers, and the highest levels of competence. We'll often ask a group of people brought together to work on core values to nominate a Mars group of 5 to 7 individuals. Not all need to come from the assembled group. Invariably, they end up selecting a powerful, credible group that does a super job of articulating the core values precisely because they are exemplars of the core values, a representative slice of the company's genetic code. As an aside, if you'd like some additional practical guidance for the Mars group, Jim has posted a set of breakout group worksheets on his website that you can download at no cost. We simply like to make these available as a free intellectual service to those who would like to get their core values and purpose nailed right. Jim's website is www.jimcollins.com. We've never encountered an organization, even global organization, composed of people from widely diverse cultures that could not identify a set of shared core values. The key is to work from the individual to the organization. Those involved in articulating the core values should wrestle with such questions as, what core values do you personally bring to your work? Core values you hold to be so fundamental that you would hold them regardless of whether they are rewarded. Imagine describing to your children and/or loved ones the core values you stand for in your work and that you would hope that they would stand for when they become working adults. What would you say? If you awoke tomorrow morning with enough money to retire for the rest of your life, would you continue to live these core values? Can you envision these core values being equally valid for you 100 years from now as they are today? Would you want to hold these core values even if at some point one or more of them became a competitive disadvantage? If you were to start a new organization tomorrow in a different line of work, what core values would you build into the new organization, regardless of its industry? The last three questions are particularly important as they make the crucial distinction between embracing core values that should not change and practices and strategies that should be changing all the time. Core purpose. Core purpose, the second component of core ideology, is the organization's fundamental reason for being. An effective purpose reflects the importance people attach to the company's work. It taps their idealistic motivations, rather than just describing the organization's output or target customers. It captures the soul of the organization. Purpose gets at the deeper reasons for an organization's existence beyond just making money. Here are some examples of core purpose. 3M, to solve unsolved problems innovatively. Mary Kay, to give unlimited opportunity to women. Merck, to preserve and improve human life. Nike, to experience the emotion of competition, winning, and crushing competitors. Sony, to experience the joy of advancing and applying technology for the benefit of the public. Telecare, to help people with mental impairments realize their full potential. Walt Disney, to make people happy. Purpose, which should be relevant for at least 100 years, should not be confused with specific goals or business strategies, which should change many times in 100 years. Whereas you might achieve a goal or complete a strategy, you cannot fulfill a purpose. It's like a guiding star on the horizon, forever pursued but never reached. Yet while purpose itself doesn't change, it does inspire change. The very fact that purpose can never be fully realized means that an organization can never stop stimulating change and progress in order to live more fully its purpose. In identifying purpose, some companies make the mistake of simply describing their current product lines or customer segments. We do not consider the following to be an effective purpose. We exist to fulfill our government charter and participate in the secondary mortgage market by packaging mortgages into investment securities. This is merely descriptive. A far more effective statement of purpose would be that expressed by the executives at Fannie Mae: to strengthen the social fabric by continually democratizing home ownership. The secondary mortgage market, as we know it, might not even exist in 100 years, but strengthening the social fabric by continually democratizing home ownership can be an enduring purpose, no matter how much the world changes. Guided and inspired by this purpose, Fannie Mae launched in the early 1990s a series of bold initiatives, including a program to develop new systems for reducing mortgage underwriting costs by 40% in 5 years. Programs to eliminate discrimination in the lending process, backed by $5 billion in underwriting experiments, and an audacious goal to provide $1 trillion, that's right, with a T, targeted at 10 million families that had traditionally been shut out of home ownership, minorities, immigrants, and low-income groups by the year 2000. A pharmaceutical company we work with considered stating their purpose as to make drugs for human therapy. We asked, would that purpose still hold 100 years from now? One manager pointed out that the company might well discover or invent new ways of improving human therapy besides traditional drugs. Another pointed out that the company would likely invent solutions for animal therapy sometime in the next few decades. A third executive pointed out that, well, I'm not here just to make stuff for therapy. I'm here to make significant improvements in therapy, to leave a mark beyond what everyone else has done. Otherwise, what's the point? Ultimately, the company captured its purpose as, we exist to provide significant improvements in therapy. This purpose can guide and inspire the company for the next 100 years. One powerful method for getting at purpose is the five whys. Start with a descriptive statement. We make X products or we deliver X services. And then ask, why is that important? Five times. After a few whys, you'll find that you're getting down to the fundamental purpose of the organization. We use this method to deepen and enrich a purpose discussion in some work we did with a market research company. The executive team first met for several hours and generated the following statement of purpose for their organization: to provide the best market research data available. We then asked the following question: why is it important to provide the best market research data available? After some discussion, their answer reflected a deeper sense of this organization's purpose: to provide the best market research data available so that our customers will understand their markets better than they could otherwise. A further discussion led the team to realize that their sense of self-worth comes not just from selling market research data, but in actually making a contribution to their customer success. This line of questioning eventually led the company to identify its purpose as to contribute to our customers' success by helping them understand their markets. With this purpose in mind, this company now frames its product decisions not with the question, will it sell, but with the question, will it make a contribution to our customers' success? Another approach is to ask each member of the Mars Group to answer the following question. If you woke up tomorrow with enough money in the bank that you would never need to work again, how could we frame the purpose of this organization such that you would want to continue working anyway? What deeper sense of purpose would motivate you to continue to dedicate your precious creative energies to this company's efforts? As we move into the 21st century, companies will need to draw on the full creative energy and talent of their people. But why should people give this level of commitment and devotion? As Peter Drucker has pointed out, the best and most dedicated people are ultimately volunteers, for they have the opportunity to do something else with their lives. With an increasingly mobile society, cynicism about corporate life, and an expanding entrepreneurial segment of the economy, companies, more than ever, need to have a clear understanding of their purpose in order to make work meaningful and thereby attract, retain, and motivate outstanding people. A very important point. You do not create or set core ideology. You discover core ideology. It's not derived by looking to the external environment. You get at it by looking inside. It has to be authentic. You can't fake an ideology, nor can you just intellectualize it. Do not ask, what core values should we hold? Ask instead, what core values do we actually hold? Core values and purpose must be passionately held on a gut level, else they are not core. Values you think the organization ought to have, but that you cannot honestly say that it does have, should not be mixed into the authentic core values. To do so creates cynicism throughout the organization. Who are they trying to kid? We all know that isn't a core value around here. The role of core ideology is to guide and inspire, not to differentiate. It's entirely possible that two companies can have the same core values or purpose. Again, it's not the content of the ideology that makes a company visionary. It's the authenticity, the discipline, and consistency with which the ideology is lived, the degree of alignment that differentiates visionary companies from the rest of the pack. It's not what you believe that sets you apart, so much as that you believe in something, that you believe in it deeply, that you preserve it over time, and that you bring it to life with consistent alignment. Core ideology need only be meaningful and inspirational to people inside the organization. It need not be exciting to all outsiders. Core ideology therefore plays an essential role in determining who's inside and who's outside the organization. A clear and well-articulated ideology attracts people to the company whose personal values are compatible with the company's core values, and conversely, repels those whose personal values are contradictory. You cannot install new core values or purpose into people. Core values and purpose are not something people buy into. People must already have a predisposition to holding them. Executives often ask, how do we get people to share our core ideology? You don't. You can't. Instead, the task is to find people who already have a predisposition to share your core values and purpose, attract and retain these people, and let those who aren't disposed to share your core values go elsewhere. The very process of articulating core ideology may result in some individuals choosing to leave when it becomes clear that they are not personally compatible with the organization's core. A positive cathartic outcome, not one to be avoided. Of course, you can still have diversity within the tight core ideology. Just because people share the same core values does not mean that they all think or look the same. Don't confuse core ideology with statements of the core ideology. A company can have a very strong core ideology without a formal statement. Nike is not, to our knowledge,